session number 11114, rule 2.
Colonel Chitty, Reel 2. You were telling me about the difficulties of arranging sanitation.
Yes. Where is it? I don't think with large pits which you dug behind your trench somewhere with a bar across.
And were they in view of the Turks? Could the Turks see those?
I think only probably might see the head of somebody. No, they were fairly well dug in. I don't think they'd see more than they would of other people in the trench. The trouble was, of course, that a lot of our trenches were end-on, which were always subject to an interlaid down the side of the trench.
Was that because the ground was rocky and difficult to dig?
No, I think it was the general position of the lines, because they had stuff that sent shells over the middle where the Australians were holding the centre, the high ground, as far as they could, and so the Turks let their shells go, and where they went over, they were fairly bad, caused some trouble. And that went on more or less all the time. I think we did occasionally. I think we had some practice, if I remember, with the Mills bomb, which was new, and it came out. We never had much actual practice as against the enemy. We were just occasionally throwing them. Know how to throw them.
How far could you throw one?
Oh, you could do it about a cricket pitch.
So you couldn't really reach the Turkish lines?
Oh, no, you have to be catching somebody, use them if they attacked, when they got close.
Did you ever do any raids to get prisoners from the other side?
No.
No trench raids?
No.
Did they attempt to raid your lines at all?
Not at the end, no. Not from the time we were on till 60. I don't think we ever had a direct attack. We were just, sniping all around the place.
So really you were holding the line and they were doing the same?
Just holding the line at the far end. Well,
what was your food like in the line?
Well, it was fairly mostly the bully beef. Occasionally, I think they called it the McConaughey ration, which was slightly more tasty, but they seldom saw it. And then you had the universal plum and apple jam with the bread, and that was what it went on like that.
Did you ever have any fresh fruit or vegetables?
No. The only possible change was if you got a tin of apricot instead of plum and apple. And you had a reasonable ration of rum, which I think, particularly towards the end, if we started off in a blazing Mediterranean summer, temperatures were in the 90s to start with. At the time we were going off, it had begun to slow. Luckily, we did have, I think we had our winter ordinary garments as opposed to the drill. We had tucked away on depots on the beach, and those so that you were able to get back out of the drill into ordinary uniform, which kept you. But I mean, you could do with the on the way out when we started to evacuate. It took us about 4 days to get people back, and of course there was no dugout or anything. The headquarters mess, we just sort of kept together, but I had a charge of a bottle to the adjutant that arranged, which was an ordinary whiskey bottle size, which was full of rum. And well, the last night, when we were dosed down, we woke up, we were literally covered in snow, and the first thing we did was to warm ourselves up out of that bottle, and there was only about a quarter of it left. We didn't feel you'd had anything. It was otherwise. Now I think we had some of the other thing, of course, was at the start. When we'd bogged down before we moved, you couldn't. Water was heavily rationed. We were limited to a pint a day, a water bottle a day. It had to last you for everything. The result was there were no baths or shaving or anything for about 3 weeks. And I had bristles all over my hair. And towards the end of that 3 weeks, luckily, we did get a little water up. One of the other officers and I got hold of the buckets, which are ordinary bucket, and we got that full of water, and then we started. First we shaved, then we started in, and we washed the top side, and then we washed down a bit more, and we began to get rid of all the lice and things, because they started. They were an awful nuisance. You couldn't do anything about it.
Did this prolonged period in a static line have any effect on the morale of the soldiers?
I don't think so, no. They settled down more or less to it. And, well, I don't remember any cases where anybody did anything that would call for court-martial. With that, no, I think they behaved extremely well.
Was the discipline in the battalion very formal?
I think well, probably not quite like up to guard standard, but at the time it was, I think it was good.
But it can be good without being formal, can't it?
Yes, well, that's why it was fairly informal, to put it that way. But, there it
is. Did you have good concealed lines back down to the beach? Were there tracks
Yes, it was. The whole ground was so up and down, was wooded. So when you started to go back to the beach, you were pretty well out of range or sight of anybody else. Until you, of course, the actual beach was to some extent open, but I don't remember any trouble going out back.
What did you think of the New Zealanders who were on your flank?
I think they were a very good lot. A curious sort of little episode, purely from the family point of view. While we were in that part of the line, we had a complete inspection. We were warned that General Birdwood was coming round. Well, that was quite good fun for me, because he was a personal friend of my parents. out in India, one is sort of able to sort of shake him by the hand but, and be fairly informal. But all of the New Zealand and Australian troops, they adored him. He was unlike our own own general, I'm afraid, who never came up to the front, not in the earlier days. We never saw him.
Did you see the Brigadier at all?
Yes, occasionally, not very much.
Where was Brigade Headquarters?
I don't know, it must have been down near the beach. I don't remember ever going there.
Presumably you had a direct telephone line to Brigade.
Yes, I think whether it worked very much, I don't know. We did all, but that one depended a lot on runners, because the lines got trodden on and it was a toss-up, really, whether they'd work.
So it was never fully reliable?
No, not at that stage.
Did you ever use semaphore?
No, because that you're too much out in the open. Unless you were in a concealed place, but you'd be asking for trouble.
What about using lamps at night? Could you flash messages?
We hadn't got any. No. The oldest lamp came in later, the other end of the war.
It sounds as though you were really rather cut off.
Well, it was, yes. I don't know if you want to know further on what happened to us after that, because as I say, we were moved down gradually. I got onto a boat. I can't remember the name of it, but it took us straight to Alexandria.
How did you actually get out of the trenches? Was it thinned out at night?
No.
How did you get the battalion out of the trenches and back to the beach?
During the night. You moved, and then you got to among trees and that. You sat tight for the day, and that. It took us about four days moving down from the front. And after that, it was straightforward.
Did you take any special measures to conceal your departure from the Turks?
No, we didn't. I think on the other side, from what I've read of the campaign, I think the Australian side of it, they did have set up one or two sort of rear guards, but by and large, the evacuation, I think the Turks were probably only too glad to see the last of us. There were practically no casualties on the landing scale. We got away.
When you had casualties when you were in the line there, what happened to them?
Well, you had stretcher bearers. They took them back to the base, and then they were put away on the hospital ships.
So you thinned out over 4 days and out onto the troop ship, and then back to Alexandria, or to Alexandria for the first time. Mm. What impression did it make on you when you arrived in Egypt?
I think I was extremely thankful. In the first, I think by and large, the time you got onto the troop ship, it was the food. Because like most of the other officers with me, one went through a ship's menu probably twice over. I know we did them so proud that when we got to Alexandria, the first thing I did was to go off to hospital with jaundice. But No, that is. And then we kept it there. We got to Alexandria, the battalion moved off to the Western Desert, where the Seleucia was supposed to be, where we camped. Not far from Alamein, but on the beach, and we had the benefit of bathing, and we were supposed to watch for the Seleucia attacking from the Western Desert, but they didn't do anything while we were there. And then later the battalion moved up to Cairo, and where in Cairo we were out by the pyramids for some time, and there I went to a school of instruction, and after a time it was a signaling course I did, and they asked me to stop as an instructor, which I did. It was at Zaitoun, about 4 or 5 miles outside Cairo. And there was quite a good school of instruction there. The boss was a Major Thomas, who had a dud arm. He had been wounded, and he was very good. He left signaling when I'd done the all the courses, telephones, helio, and all that. And they said, "Will you stop and be an instructor?" Well, by that time the battalion were down on the canal, and that was extremely dull. And in fact, after a time, Kitchener came out to see how we were dealing with the Turks. It was in the days when the Turks were attacking right up to the canal, and he got after them, and he said, "Get out of it. Get out the other side. You're guarding the canal from the Turks. You're not letting the canal guard you." And the battalion, we were shot out onto the far side, where we lived in trenches in the sand, which was very difficult because you don't do the lug well. Then they filled up again. But
must have been very dull for them.
Yes, it was.
Must have been very dull for them.
Yes, that the Turks came back, and then after, as I say, I was away from the battalion, and that was replenished with a new CO. One of our original majors came back and took charge of Barrington Wells. I don't know if he got his name at all. He ended up with the battalion, and the brigadier, division Archibald Murray, was a brigadier, and by that time they'd driven the Turks back to the Gaza line, which I know if you were, it was a sort of rather high ground running inland about 20 or 30 miles into the desert. And the front of it was, they guarded it along with lots of machine guns and everything. And there was about 2,000 yards of desert and a slight dip like that. And our battalion was along there.
In the dip? Were they in the dip?
No, at the edge of this hill. They were dug in with trenches of a sort. And there was shooting was very desultory in the way of heavy stuff. And so by that time I was back in Zaitoun, and Barry decided to attack the Turkish thing straight from the front. So he sent the whole brigade, our brigade, forward into it, and the result was, at the end of the day, only three of our officers were alive. And I heard about this, and they, I think they said for me, they told me this, I said, well, I'll go back, naturally. So, and they were driven back, the rest of them were still entrenched along this line when I joined the then CO, and we had a few telephone lines to connect along the front, and I was in a small dugout, barely not underground, but little holes, and there were two lines ran away from the front of me, about as far as that towards that cushion, that sofa, and the one of the Turkish shells, really 12-pounder, I think it dropped exactly on the two lines, cut them in half. But I was just further back, so no damage was done.
Did you?
And they kept us, you see, and they had the rest of the brigade later on. And that was this attack was February. Then Murray tried to do exactly the same thing in April again, and the other two brigades were cut up, and that left the two of us and the Welsh division, which were on our left, were just holding that line. And so it was for nearly a year until Allenby came out. Allenby had a good look round, and he was a real soldier. He knew what he was doing. And so he said, we've got to go on. This was, I was getting towards the end of the war, really, but he had the Australian Mounted Brigade, which he, and also like a good cavalry soldier as he was, he sent them out into the desert about 30 miles away there, and they made a circle round, and they came down and charged the mass along this ridge where the Turks were, and of course absolutely set them off. They ran like rabbits and never stopped till they were up nearly Damascus. That was the last stage of the war.
The attack on Beersheba?
Yes, it was Beersheba attack.
Did the, when you were in this line, facing the Gaza line, did you ever, did you get to the point of burying the telephone cables in the ground to protect them from shoals?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. It was purely luck. Otherwise, the lines were fairly good. It just happened to be a chance shot. Even then, we didn't have too much in the way of wire and that.
Did you have any mines to protect the front?
No. No, they hadn't got around to that side of fighting, I don't think, that time. There were no mines.
Did the Turks ever make any large-scale attacks on
our mines? No, not after. The last one they'd done was on the canal. And I think it was the Gloucesters. Gloucester Hussars had a scrap with them, and they didn't like it, and that was where they retreated back to this Gaza line until Allenby drove them out of it.
Was there a lot of patrol activity between the lines?
No, I don't think it was too open. You could see all that you wanted to see without roaming forward.
Did you manage to get a system of relief and rotation so that you could go back for rest in Egypt?
I don't know, because very soon after that I went back to Zaitoun, and And at that time, there was a rather, just towards the end of the war, and I'd done a lot of signalling and things, that I got very keen on the flying. I had an Indian friend, and two others, who were in the flying corps in Heliopolis. And so I put in to join them, and I went over just under the year. I was doing the ordinary course for a pilot of those days. I just about completed all the groundwork. Then the armistice broke out, and they all threw us out. All they didn't have any of the would-be flyers who hadn't actually been in the air. They just threw them back to their regiments, which by that time was up on our regiment, got forward with Allenby, was on Mount Carmel. I stayed there for a bit, but I had no rail connection now. They didn't want signalers. And I'd thought I'd have a bit of leave, and so I did get enough leave just to go out to India for a short time, because it was in May that my father retired for good from Calcutta, and I came back with them, and I got offered service, and went back to Zaitoun. That time we were, as soon as I could do it, we were debarbed. I was debarbed in July.
Were there any important advances in the art of signalling while you were instructing at Zaitoun?
Yes, there were one or two. One thing, we got the D3 phones out, and a development of that was I was very keen on was the Fuller phone, which was invented by General Fuller, who was a sapper, and the effect, I don't know if you know that the ordinary telephone with its earth return could be tapped by the enemy if they want to. They could put things in the ground and get. Well, now the Fuller phone defeated all the tapping, because instead of signals going out bang, bang like that and stopping, which is what the enemy picked up, it had a resistance in the sending coil, which smoothed the signal. It went out so smoothly that nobody could pick it up. And I did, we used the helio quite a lot, but it actually, helio wasn't much use in Egypt itself, because you wouldn't think it. You were on a brilliant sunshine day, but the air is so full of dust that one day I had my helio, or the chaps, about half a dozen of them, I said, we'll have an exercise. And so we drove out to the pyramids, and I walked up with my, see, I took my helio thing up to the top of the first pyramid, up there, where you could see Zaitoun, or just. And you really had great difficulty in making contact, because the dust prevented you getting a good sunlight getting through. Whereas if you were in South Africa, you could signal 100 miles. And so it didn't really prove very useful.
You mentioned the arrival of the Aldis lamp before the end of the war.
I think it was the only thing I saw of it was probably in the Navy, the destroyers that were going up and down the canal. I remember one night when I was out there, they had a searchlight or something going, and I could read what they were, from the flash on the sky, what the chap was sending. which was something to do with some of his coat and trousers he wanted sending somewhere else. But I think the oldest was much more naval use. I don't think we used it.
Do you remember having anything to do with wireless?
Only toying with it. We didn't have any wireless arrangements, but